Divers gathered on the Seeker for a headcount near midnight. A gang caller had arrived decked out in his gang colors. Denim jacket, skull and crossbones patch, Atlantic Wreck Divers logo. Chatterton shook his head at the sight. Kohler shot back his own look, one that said, "You got a fucking problem?" Neither spoke a word. Memories of Feldman still arched over the Seeker. Each diver answered yeah or yo when his name was called, then made his way to the salon without much of the usual carousing and joking. Lying in their bunks on opposite ends of the salon, Chatterton and Kohler mentally rehearsed their dive plans. Chatterton would use his first dive for two purposes. First, he would follow the advice of Harry Cooper of the Shark Hunters Club and inspect the submarine for saddle tanks, the externally affixed compartments primarily used for fuel in Type 7 U-boats, the most common of the German fleet. If he had time, he would also look to see if the submarine contained two stern torpedo tubes, the narrow cylinders by which the fired weapon left the boat. Cooper had suggested that a U-boat so configured was likely one of the larger Type 9 models, while the Type 7s contained just a single stern torpedo tube. For his part, Kohler had the eagle and swastika in his crosshairs. Every day for 6 weeks he had imagined recovering a Nazi dish of his own, of reaching into a mystery and pulling out a witness to a time when the world could have gone either way. He would not tolerate another day without ownership of such history. He was going straight for the dishes. Chatterton dressed early the next morning. He, Packer, and Gatto would set the hook, then dive the wreck first. They would enjoy pristine visibility, but would create silt and sediment clouds for subsequent divers, making artifact recovery more difficult. Kohler got wind of the plan. He stormed the stairs to the wheelhouse, where Chatterton was shooting the breeze with Nagel. "Bill, what the hell is going on with this guy?" Kohler asked, pointing to Chatterton. "What's wrong, Richie?" Nagel asked. "He's gonna fuck the viz for me. I'm going forward for dishes. He went first last time. Let me go first today."
"John's going to videotape," Nagel said. "You splash after him. And don't go forward and mess up his viz. He needs clean water to shoot in."
"What? Why does he automatically splash first every time? He eats all the good viz while the rest of us get silt and clouds. Where's our fair shot?"
"Listen, Richie," Chatterton interjected. "You don't know what it's like down there yet."
"You're right," Kohler interrupted. "No one knows what it's like because we can never go down there in good viz. I plan to go forward today. I'm looking for dishes. Now Bill tells me I gotta go somewhere else. That's a little unfair, don't you think?"
"John's going first. He's a captain," Nagel said. "There's plenty of room on the U-boat, Richie. Go somewhere else on your first dive."
Kohler shook his head and returned to the deck, muttering patchwork expletives that all ended in the word Chatterton. He hated Nagel's decision, but would respect the word of a captain on his own boat. He would go somewhere else on the wreck. The water was calm and the skies partly cloudy when Chatterton, Packer, and Gatto splashed. They tied into the wreck just above the damaged control room, then waved good luck to one another and parted ways. Chatterton swam along the side of the submarine, searching for the saddle tanks Cooper had spoken of. He saw none. This was good evidence that the submarine was not a Type 7, and an invaluable piece of information in further researching the wreck. He would inspect the stern torpedo tubes later. To swim that distance now would consume too much valuable dive time. Instead, he would enter the wreck in the control room below him and videotape his push toward the forward torpedo room. As Chatterton moved to go inside the wreck, he could see Packer and Gatto still hovering outside the U-boat's torn-open control room. He knew the body language of excellent divers. The team had taken measure of the sub's tangle of interior dangers and had decided against challenging the wreck straight away. "Smart guys," Chatterton thought to himself as he drifted inside. At least for now, Packer and Gatto were not going to identify the wreck. The control room, for all its ground zero devastation, looked like home to Chatterton. He had studied videotapes of his last dives the way a football coach watches film, memorizing formations and openings, and visioning jogs and hopscotches that might deliver him past the myriad obstacles. He had not been to the U-boat for 6 weeks, but he saw order in the chaos for all his video study, and that feeling of mastery was what he had come for. Chatterton glided forward through the control room, crocheting himself between dangling cables, juking around dead machinery, and pointing his camera in every direction until he had passed the commander's quarters on the port side and the sound and radio rooms to the starboard. He moved easily past the galley to the officers' quarters, the place where he had found the dishes in late September. Now it was time to push toward the forward torpedo room, the U-boat's forwardmost compartment. But the navigational videos he had memorized from previous trips went snowy in his brain. He had never been this far forward. If he was to continue forward, he would have to do so by guts and instinct. Video camera raised high in the compartment, Chatterton moved his fins and inched forward. A wooden partition materialized before him. The path to the torpedo room was blocked by a fallen piece of cabinetry. Chatterton swam closer. He allowed the water around him to still. Slowly, he raised his right arm to shoulder level and opened his palm, then held the position motionless, as if he were a python about to strike at prey. When everything in the compartment settled, he thrust his arm forward, crashing his hand into the partition. The wood exploded, spitting a cloud of sawdust and debris about the room. Chatterton froze and allowed the dying wood its fall. When the bulk of the particulate matter had sunk to the floor and some of the visibility returned, he could see the circular hatch leading to the torpedo room at the front end of the U-boat. He moved his fins and again crept forward. Now he hovered in the non-commissioned officers' quarters, the place where crewmen like the navigator, chief machinist, and senior radioman slept. Chatterton remembered from Chicago that there might be dishes and other artifacts in the compartment. He scanned the debris and sediment piled on the port side floor area for the familiar white of China. He saw the white. He inched closer. This was a different white. He moved still closer, until the white became a round shape with eye sockets and cheekbones and a nasal cavity and an upper jaw. This was a skull. Chatterton stopped. He allowed some silt to settle. Beside the skull lay a long bone, perhaps a forearm or shin, and beside it several smaller bones. Chatterton recalled the open hatches atop the submarine. If men had attempted to flee this U-boat, at least some of them had never made it out alive. Now Chatterton faced a decision. He had been advised by some to search pockets, boots, and other personal effects he might discover inside the sub. Those were the likeliest places to find a silver wristwatch or a wallet inscribed with a crewman's name, or maybe a cigarette lighter or cigarette case a crewman had taken to a silversmith to have his U-boat's number engraved on it. Chatterton knew that clothes and personal effects often lay near bones. He did not move. If he searched for personal effects, however carefully, he might disturb the human remains, and he was not willing to do that. He had contemplated this possibility after discovering the dishes and realizing that the boat had likely sunk with crewmen aboard, and in every iteration he came out resolved the same. This was a war grave, and these were fallen soldiers. He knew firsthand what fallen soldiers looked like, and what a fallen soldier meant in a world of wars and maniac leaders. He had seen life pass from young men defending their country, and knew that whatever the politics or justness of a country's cause, a soldier deserved respect in death. He also understood that he might someday have to answer to a family about the bones before him,
and he was unwilling to say that he had shuffled those remains in order to identify a shipwreck and maybe gain himself a little glory. Chatterton turned his head away from the skull so as not to stare. He kicked his fins and moved forward, allowing the remains to fade back to blackness behind him. A moment later, the forward torpedo room took shape in the distance. As Chatterton drifted closer, he could see that the room's round hatch, the hole through which crewmen had moved in and out, was open but blocked by a piece of fallen machinery. Chatterton lifted the obstruction, moved it aside, and swam into the compartment. Two torpedoes, including the one he had seen from atop the submarine on the Labor Day discovery trip, lay poised and pointed forward, seemingly as ready for firing as they had been during World War II. Only the top two of the room's four torpedo tubes were visible. The other pair lay underneath several feet of silt and debris that had piled up and into the middle of the room. Chatterton knew from research that the torpedo tube hatches were sometimes marked by identifying tags. He also recalled that the torpedo men often wrote their nicknames or the names of girlfriends and wives on the outside of the hatches. He swam forward and searched for such evidence, but any trace of a tag or writing on the hatches had been eaten away by time and seawater. This wreck, even at its tip, refused to surrender its secret. Chatterton panned his camera around the room in slow motion, capturing as much detail as possible for later study. The bunks that had once hung from the port and starboard walls no longer existed. The boxes of food and supplies that the torpedo men slept beside or atop in this compartment had vaporized long ago. The rigging, used to move the massive torpedoes into their firing tubes, lay fractured in the sediment. A white speck caught his eye. He aimed his light at the shape. Fish scurried through cracked machinery to escape the brightness. In the light, he saw a human bone, then another, then dozens more. Many men had died in this room, the place farthest from the cataclysmic control room damage. "Jesus, what happened to this ship?" Chatterton mumbled through his regulator. He turned around to leave. Before he could begin his swim out, he came face to face with a femur, the largest and strongest bone in the human body. He averted his gaze and drifted past it slowly until he had exited the torpedo room. The postscript to Chatterton's entrance was a swirling black silt that reduced visibility to zero. To exit the wreck, he would have to follow a map that existed solely in his brain. Chatterton began picking and finger-walking his way through the compartments, reversing memorized pathways and anticipating remembered dangers. Passing through the non-commissioned officers' quarters, he hugged the sub's starboard side in order to leave undisturbed the human remains he had seen while coming in. In nearly total darkness, he moved through spaces other divers would not tempt on foot in a well-lit gymnasium. Again he survived by favoring learning over artifacts. Again preparation delivered him from a web of obstacles and traps. Chatterton exited the wreck through the control room, swam toward the flashing strobe he had clipped to the anchor line, and began a 90-minute ascent to the surface. Still steaming over Chatterton's dibs on the U-boat's forward section, Kohler decided to explore aft instead. Remembering an area of damage on top of the wreck's stern, he wondered if he might gain entrance to an unexplored section there. His instincts were excellent. The damaged area had been blasted open by some external force. He could see that much because the metal had been forced down and into the U-boat. And while the damage was nowhere near as extensive as that in the control room, it left enough room for a courageous diver to drop in and land where he might. Kohler hovered above the open wound, burped a breath of air from his buoyancy compensator, and sank into the U-boat. As Kohler settled into the wreck, he detected the outline of two adjacent torpedo tubes in the haze of his white light. At once he understood where he was and the implication of his discovery. This was the aft torpedo room inside what was likely a Type 9 U-boat, the kind built for patrols of longer range and duration. Though Chatterton had intended to inspect the stern torpedo tubes himself, Kohler had beaten him to it. In just a half hour, the two divers had answered the two most important technical questions about the mystery U-boat. Kohler shined his lights about the room. Under some fallen debris, he found a metal tag and an escape lung, the combination life vest and breathing apparatus used by crewmen to escape a submerged U-boat. Kohler's pulse raced. These were just the kind of items that often bore identifying marks. He pulled them close to his mask. Any writing that might have been embossed on the tag, however, had been eaten away by nature. The lung, small technical marvel though it was, came up blank as well. Kohler packed the items in his goodie bag and began a short swim aft to get a closer look at the torpedo tubes. Like Chatterton, he knew that the tube hatches had often been tagged and sometimes bore the names of the crewmen's loves. Kohler never got to the tubes. During his swim, he noticed the edge of a white dish protruding from the debris on the floor. Pay dirt. He would score some china after all. He crab-walked toward the dish, careful not to raise any more silt than was necessary. Would the china contain the eagle and swastika? Could this be his greatest discovery of all? Kohler had to force himself not to lunge forward and start grabbing. Slowly, slowly, slowly. Finally, he completed the 10-foot swim. He suggested his hand forward and put the gentlest of squeezes on the china. The dish bent forward. Kohler let go. It sprung back into shape. Kohler understood at once. He had made the prize-winning discovery of a chinette plate, something not invented until 30 years after the last U-boat had sailed. New divers are often surprised to find such modern objects aboard old shipwrecks, but a veteran like Kohler had seen Budweiser cans, plastic prescription medicine bottles, a Kotex applicator, even a Barney the Dinosaur balloon on 100-year-old wrecks. And he understood that such objects had been dropped off passing boats and had drifted along the ocean bottom until they got caught up in a wreck. Kohler removed the plate and stuffed it in his goodie bag, the underwater equivalent of picking up a hot dog wrapper in a park. Silt spilled around the hole he made. Another white object came into view. This one was no paper plate. This one was a femur. Kohler went cold. Unlike Chatterton, he had rehearsed no plan for dealing with human remains. He had never seen bones on a wreck before this. And he had never faced a moral decision at 230 feet with narcosis banging. He knew this. He was no grave robber. He would not disturb bones to get artifacts. But should he dig nearby? That was a different story. Nearby was different. He looked again at the femur. He turned even colder. His breathing became more rapid. Kohler backed away several inches, and in his movement, the silt swirled black and buried the bone as quickly as it had been revealed. He had spent the last 6 weeks learning about U-boat men. He had come to sense the punishing and tedious nature of their work, the constant peril of their patrols, the hopelessness of their late war situation. All that, however, was an experience of the mind. Here was a femur, the strongest of human bones, torn free from what had once been a human being. That bone was the bridge between book and imagination. And it stopped Kohler. Soon his coldness was replaced by a pall of regret. He found himself thinking, "I didn't mean to disturb you," as he watched the area where he had seen the bone. He decided to return to the seeker. Kohler worked his way forward until he was under the damaged opening at the ceiling. injected a bit of air into his wings, and descended out of the U-boat. A few minutes later he began his 90-minute ascent up the anchor line. For a while he contemplated the fate of a U-boat in which men had died so far away from the boat's epicenter of damage. But as his decompression continued, the crescendo of his frustration with Chatterton renewed. He could not tolerate the idea of this diver stealing the visibility in a gold mine of artifacts under the pretext of shooting video. A mystery U-boat full of china, and the guy is shooting video. As Kohler climbed aboard the Seeker, divers gathered to inspect the tag and escape lung he had recovered. Some told him of Chatterton's push to the forward torpedo room. Kohler had heard enough. He decided to have another word with Nagel. In the wheelhouse, his dry suit still dripping, Kohler explained to Nagel that his culture was Atlantic wreck divers to the core, an ethos in which divers worked as a team for the good of the group. None of this me-first-every-time bullshit. Chatterton entered the room behind him. Kohler rolled his eyes. Chatterton shut the door and spoke in a near whisper. "I saw skulls up front," he said. "I saw a long bone, a femur, in the back," Kohler answered. "There are a lot of bones up front," Chatterton said. "Did you videotape the skull?" Kohler asked. "No, I didn't videotape any of the bones." "What? You didn't videotape the bones? You steal the viz so you can shoot video, then you come across human remains and you don't tape them? What the hell were you doing down there?" For a moment, Chatterton said nothing. Nagel waved his hand as if to say, "Leave me out of this." "I deliberately did not video them," Chatterton said. "It's a matter of respect." Kohler begrudgingly nodded his agreement and left the wheelhouse. In the salon he fixed himself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and relaxed. He would need to spend 3 hours off-gassing his body's built-up nitrogen before he could splash for a second dive. Chatterton entered a few minutes later, popped his videotape into the VCR, and studied his first dive. Neither said anything to the other. Chatterton was the first to return to the water. His goal was to search the area around the galley and the non-commissioned officers' quarters for cabinets that might contain the ship's logbook, maps, or other written materials like those he knew had been safely stored in wooden furniture on the Chicago U-boat. He would avoid the forward section of the NCO quarters so as not to disturb the human remains he had seen there. Chatterton had little trouble reaching his target area. He got purchase on some low-lying machinery and began digging, feeling around for cabinet shapes. He found none, but he did run his hand along a smaller object he took to be a box. A moment later, he had unearthed the item from beneath a pile of silt and sediment. It appeared to be a silverware drawer about 11 inches by 8 inches, with sections for knives, spoons, and forks. A gelatinous black mud had cocooned the drawer and had sealed its contents. Chatterton looked closer and saw the outline of spoons in one of the sections. He nestled the silverware drawer into his bag and turned back for the anchor line. Perhaps there might be a date or year stamped on one of the utensils inside. Not long after Chatterton had departed the sub, Kohler entered. This time, he beelined to the forward part of the wreck, exactly where Chatterton had recovered the dishes on the last trip. If he had to deal with Chatterton silt, so be it. He was going to bag up. The visibility was not as bad as Kohler had expected. He could see landmarks, and to an Atlantic wreck diver, landmarks meant life. He navigated through the last remnants of Chatterton's haze and into the non-commissioned officers' quarters, a penetration only he and Chatterton dared risk on so virgin a wreck. He poked through sediment and debris, looking for the rounded white corners and feeling for the smooth surfaces that meant china to savvy divers. He found a 4-inch-tall cologne bottle imprinted with a German word, Glockengasse, which he took to be a brand name. He remembered that U-boat men splashed cologne on themselves to battle the body odor inevitable on 100-day patrols in broiling boats in which showers were unavailable. But he had not come for cologne. He had come for dishes. He resumed his search in earnest, running his hand through silt and sediment the way a child works a sandbox. He found nothing. He dug farther. As he cleared some debris, he came upon what he could only describe to himself as a boneyard. Skulls, ribs, a femur, shins, a forearm. That cold settled over him again. "I'm standing in a mass grave," he told himself. "I need to leave now." He packed the cologne bottle into his bag and turned around. The silt worsened from haze to black. Kohler breathed deeply and shut his eyes for a moment. Navigate. As long as you can breathe, you're okay. He remembered his way and reversed it in his mind. He maneuvered back out of the U-boat as if following a trail of lighted breadcrumbs. The Atlantic wreck divers had taught him well. Back near the surface, Chatterton clipped his goodie bag to a line attached to the boat. He dared not climb the Seeker's ladder in bouncy seas holding such delicate bounty. On board, he undressed and dried, then fished his bag from the ocean. Divers gathered to inspect the haul. Chatterton took the silverware drawer from his bag and reached into the gelatin. A methane smell of rotten eggs and petroleum burst from the artifact, a final protest at being wrested from its peace. Various expletives ushered forth from the onlookers. The first items out were silver-plated forks, stacked one atop another. Only these forks had been consumed so fully by electrolysis that all that remained was the rice paper-thin shape of the fork, the form of the fork. Nagel stepped forward. He had seen this kind of artifact before, and understood that the slightest jolt could cause it to crumble into powder. He reached to spread the forks across the table for closer inspection. His hands shook from years of heavy drinking and hard living. He stopped and gathered himself, and seemed to be asking a favor of his body, if only this once, to settle down long enough to be part of such a moment. His hands went quiet. He reached forward and took the forks and, without breathing, separated each from the others and laid them on the table. Each of the forks was stamped, on the underside of its handle at the widest part, with the eagle and swastika. Nagel moved them around delicately, searching for any other identifying mark. When he found none, he backed away and began breathing again. His hands began to shake so badly that he struggled just to put them in his pockets. Next out of the drawer came several stainless steel spoons, these still sturdy enough to use for breakfast cereal. The spoons were spread on the table for inspection. They bore no marks. That left only one section of the silverware drawer, the knives. Chatterton looked closely. Only one utensil appeared to be in that section, a knife with a stainless steel blade and wood handle. He fished into the remaining gelatin and pulled out the utensil. The knife was covered in mud. Chatterton dunked it in a bucket of fresh water and began rubbing the handle between his thumb and forefinger to remove the dirt. As the mud flaked away, he began to feel the imprint of letters beneath his thumb. He dunked again and rubbed harder. More letters pressed against his thumb. The hair on the back of his neck stood up. The other divers crowded closer. Chatterton kept rubbing. The final crusts of clay fell to the table. Beneath his thumb, carved into the knife's handle in handwritten letters, was a name. It said, Horenberg. For several seconds, no one moved or said anything. Finally, Brad Sheard, the aerospace engineer, stepped forward and clapped Chatterton on the back. "Well, that's it, man," Sheard said. "You've identified the U-boat. All you have to do is find crewman Horenberg. Congratulations!
This might be the best artifact I've ever taken from any wreck, Chatterton told the divers. This guy actually carved his name into the knife. It's not like a tag that was made in a factory. This is like a personal message. All I need to do is find Horenberg, and the U-boat is identified.
By this time, Kohler had climbed aboard the boat. He and the other divers took turns inspecting the knife and congratulating Chatterton, each of them gracious, but also disappointed that he had not been the one to identify the wreck.
"Call me tomorrow when you find Horenberg and let me know which boat this is," the divers told Chatterton. Packer and Gatto, who had penetrated only the wreck's stern on their second dive, shook Chatterton's hand. As the Seeker steamed back toward shore, Chatterton joined Nagel in the wheelhouse and took over the helm, and the two began a post-mortem on the day. A few minutes later, Kohler walked in. Nagel offered him a beer and invited him to stay. Kohler mumbled additional congratulations to Chatterton. Nagel sensed that Kohler was still sore about Chatterton's decision to dive first, and perhaps a little jealous over the knife. Never one to pass up a potential confrontation, especially after a few beers, Nagel elbowed the divers in trademark Nagel fashion.
"Richie, if you don't like John splashing first, maybe you should put up a grate and lock him out," Nagel said, cackling. "Maybe you should leave him a sign on the grate that says, 'Closed for inventory.'"
Nagel's ear-to-ear grin looked half-satanic, half-schoolboy. Both divers knew that the captain adored confrontation, and each hated to be a pawn to this appetite. But the subject of the Andrea Doria grate had been festering since Kohler had joined the U-boat trip, and Nagel, the clever bastard, had lit a fuse.
"Maybe we should get things out in the open," Kohler said.
"Fine," Chatterton replied. "I'll tell you this. I don't like you Atlantic wreck divers. You tried to fuck me on the Doria."
"Yeah, okay, we did," Kohler said.
"If it wasn't for one honest guy from your little club, we would never have known. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but it's obvious only one of you guys has a conscience."
"Look," Kohler said, "I already came to terms with Bill on the grate. We did try to fuck you, yeah, I admit it. Do you want an apology? Do you want me to start crying and beg your forgiveness? Is that what you want?"
"I don't need an apology," Chatterton said. "We beat you at your own game. That grate was the best revenge. For me, it ended there."
"So you won," Kohler said. "I'm not going to flog myself. It ends there for me, too. And by the way, I don't like your kind either. Everything is so serious with you about diving. At least we know how to have fun."
"Moaning families on passing boats and making up pornographic dive schedules and wearing little matching uniforms is fun?"
"Hell yeah, it's fun. You should try it."
"That's the problem with you guys."
"We got no problems."
"Oh, you got plenty of problems."
"Ah, fuck it," Kohler said, downing the last of his beer.
He left the wheelhouse for the deck, where he found a seat on top of a giant cooler. A few minutes later, Chatterton came down the ladder and sat beside him. For a while, neither spoke.
"Listen, Richie," Chatterton finally said. "I don't need to be the first one to splash every time. If you don't mind setting the hook, you're welcome to go first next time. But remember, tying in is a gamble. If you run into trouble, you can blow your whole dive while you fix things."
"I don't mean to be a prick," Kohler said. "I respect you. I just want a fair shot."
Again, neither spoke for a few minutes. Then Kohler began to tell Chatterton that he was feeling like the U-boat meant something more to him than the chance to load up on Nazi artifacts. He explained that he had been buying and reading books like a man possessed since his first trip to the wreck. But maybe something in his German heritage was connecting with this mission. That while he was eager to recover artifacts from this U-boat, he also found himself captivated by the history of the U-boat war and the men who had fought it. He asked if Chatterton had yet read Gunter Hessler's book,
The U-Boat War in the Atlantic, 1939 to 1945. Then provided a detailed review. To Chatterton, these were not the typical leanings of an Atlantic wreck diver. Chatterton walked into the salon to get a package of peanut butter crackers. He came back and sat beside Kohler again. "Listen," Chatterton said. "I got a lot of calls and letters after the media got hold of this story. I think you might really find some of them interesting." For the next 3 hours, Chatterton regaled Kohler with news of the last few weeks, of hearing from the Civil Air Patrol, of the blimp pilot, of the families and kooks and self-professed experts, of Harry Cooper of Shark Hunters, of U-boat ace Merton and the story of his colleague Weingartner, who might just have had the gumption to flout orders and take his Type 9 submarine to New Jersey instead of to the Indian Ocean. Kohler gulped the information and asked endless questions, all of which Chatterton found incisive and open-ended. As night fell and the Seeker made its way into the inlet near Brielle, the divers walked toward the salon to pack their belongings. Inside, Chatterton asked Kohler for his address. "You going to send me something?" Kohler asked. "I'd like to send you the videotape I shot today, and some others," Chatterton said. "You have to promise me that you won't show them to anyone or let them out of your hands. I've been burned by that before, as you know. But I think it can really help you navigate the wreck. I'm going to trust you with this." "Thanks, man," Kohler said. He jotted down his address. "You have my word." That night, Chatterton took the knife he had discovered and placed it on his desk. The name Horenberg looked as clearly carved as the day the crewman had inscribed it. "Who were you?" he asked as he gazed at the knife. "What happened to your U-boat? And who were you?" He closed the lights to his office and made his way to his bedroom. "Just another day or two," he said to himself. "Just another day or two, and I'll have the answer to the mystery of the U-boat." Chapter 8 Nothing at That Location. The morning after Chatterton recovered the knife, he set out to find Horenberg. To this end, he wrote a letter detailing his discovery and mailed it to four experts, each of whom he believed could trace Horenberg and thereby identify the mystery U-boat. Those experts were Harry Cooper, president of Shark Hunters, whose connections ran deep in the U-boat world; Carl Friedrich Merton, the U-boat ace in Germany with whom Chatterton had been corresponding, and who believed the mystery sub to be U-851, the one commanded by his colleague; Charlie Grutzemacher, curator of the International Submarine Document Center in Dyssenhofen, Germany, a renowned repository of U-boat information; Horst Bredow, a U-boat veteran and founder of the U-boat Archive in Cuxhaven-Altenbruck, Germany, the world's leading repository of personal U-boat information, and the place to which the German government often referred researchers. By Chatterton's calculation, it should take no more than a week to receive the answer. For his part, Kohler continued to rampage through historical texts, learning the patrols of America-bound U-boats. In these pursuits, Chatterton with the knife, Kohler with the books, each was answering to more than a mystery. Each believed that once the U-boat was identified, he had a responsibility to the families of the fallen soldiers and to history to explain why the U-boat was in American waters, how it had slipped through history's cracks, and how it had met its end. And if there was a Mrs. Horenberg, she deserved to know why her husband lay buried off the New Jersey coast and why no one in the world knew that he was there. A week passed without reply. Then another week. Chatterton sat beside his phone, willing it to ring. He checked between the pages of junk mail flyers for the pale blue of an airmail envelope. A month passed without a reply. He wrote to his sources again. Each told him the same thing. "There's been some confusion.
We're still working on it. Just after Christmas, nearly 2 months after his initial inquiry, Chatterton's phone rang. It was a U-boat enthusiast with whom Chatterton had recently become acquainted. The man had news. "The knife is a dead end, Mr. Chatterton. You have to go back to the wreck." "What do you mean it's a dead end?" "There was only one man in the U-boat service named Horenberg, and he never served in the Western Atlantic." "What U-boats did he serve on?" "He doesn't remember." For a moment, Chatterton could not speak. Only the sound of telephone static convinced him that the man was still on the line. Finally, he choked out the question. "Horenberg is alive?" "He's alive," the man said. "He survived the sinking?" "I didn't say that." "What did Horenberg say?" "He said it's a dead end." "What's a dead end?" "The knife. He doesn't remember the knife."
"What else did he say?"
"Forget it, Mr. Chatterton. You should move on."
"Wait a minute. I would like to talk to Horenberg."
"Oh, that's impossible. He talks to nobody."
"Please, tell him I'd like to speak to him. This is everything to me. If this is his knife, I'd like to return it to him."
"He doesn't want to talk."
"Can you at least tell me what U-boat he was on?"
"He doesn't recall anything."
"You need to go on from here.
I'm sorry I can't help you further. I must go. Goodbye."
Chatterton sat stunned, unable to hang up. Horenberg is alive? He doesn't remember the knife? He talks to nobody? Chatterton held the phone to his ear, oblivious to the phone company's recorded warnings while he processed the impossible. "A knife with a crewman's name. The best artifact I have ever found. And it's a dead end?"
For the next several days, Chatterton thought obsessively of Horenberg. The man had survived the war, lived into old age, and was in a position to announce the answer to the mystery. Yet he wouldn't talk. Why not? What reason could he have for not at least providing his U-boat number? A few days later, Chatterton received replies from Merton, Bredow, and Grutzemacher. Each of them had reached the same conclusion. There had been only one Horenberg in the German Navy, Martin Horenberg, a Funkmeister, or senior radioman, in the U-boat service. His last patrol had been aboard U-869, a U-boat sunk by Allied forces off Africa in 1945. That U-boat's entire crew, including Horenberg, had been killed in the attack. It was the only patrol U-869 had ever made. It had happened 3,650 miles from the mystery wreck site. Now Chatterton was furious. He was certain that his three German sources, all respected experts, were correct about Horenberg. That meant, however, that the U-boat enthusiast had not spoken to Martin Horenberg, if he had spoken to anyone. On the spot, Chatterton wrote the man off and resolved never to speak to him again. Still, he remained unconvinced that his German sources had pursued the matter to the ends of the earth, as he would have. Perhaps there had been another Horenberg they had overlooked. Chatterton had heard about a U-boat memorial in Germany inscribed with the names of U-boat veterans killed in action. If he traveled to Germany, he could inspect that memorial himself, every last listing, if necessary, in search of another Horenberg. Yes, if he went to Germany, he could study that memorial, visit the U-boat museum, and have at Bredow's archive himself. He checked his calendar. March would be a good month to do this right. Chatterton invited Jurga and Kohler to accompany him to Germany. Jurga accepted. Kohler, who ran his own business, could not free himself for the week-long expedition. But the invitation moved him. Chatterton was serious about this mission,
and would not have included anyone he did not respect or whose help he could not rely on.
"I'll work stateside," Kohler told Chatterton. "I'll keep my end going here."
As the March trip approached, Chatterton received a telephone call unlike any since the media storm had begun. An elderly gentleman introduced himself as Gordon Vaith, a former intelligence officer for the Atlantic Fleet airships during World War II, the blimp squadrons. He had read of the diver's discovery and asked about any research Chatterton had undertaken. Chatterton told him of his slow correspondence with the Naval Historical Center.
"If you'd like to come to Washington, I would be more than happy to introduce you to the heads of the center, who are my friends," Vaith said. "Maybe they can help you find what you're looking for. I don't intend to insinuate myself, but if I can help in any way, it should be my pleasure."
Chatterton could scarcely believe his good fortune. Vaith had been on the spot for anti-submarine warfare, in intelligence no less, and he had connections at the NHC. They made a date to meet in Washington for late February. As Chatterton hung up, he wondered if the trip to Germany would be necessary anymore. If anyone knew the answer to the mystery, it had to be the American government. Now, with Vaith's help, he would be escorted straight to the source. A few days later, Chatterton made the 4-hour drive to Washington, D.C. He was due to meet Vaith at the Naval Historical Center at 10 a.m. He arrived an hour early and pulled into the vast Washington Navy Yard, an ancient-looking complex of trolley tracks, cobblestoned roads, libraries, and classrooms. A retired Navy destroyer moored in the Anacostia River peeked at Chatterton from behind a stone building as he made his way to the NHC, storehouse for many of the Navy's historical documents and artifacts. Inside, a snowy-haired man dressed in a tweed jacket rose to greet Chatterton. He introduced himself as Gordon Vaith. The men became acquainted, and Vaith outlined his plan for the visit. He would introduce Chatterton to Bernard Cavalcanti, the head of operational archives and a world-renowned U-boat expert, and Dr. Dean Allard, the director of the center. Those two men, Vaith suggested, had access to nearly everything the United States knew about U-boats. Chatterton breathed deeply. He now believed himself minutes away from the answer to the mystery. Vaith escorted Chatterton into Cavalcanti's office. "These rooms," Vaith explained, "contain the vast majority of American naval records, and it is Cavalcanti, a passionate historian born for the job, who oversees them."
"And he's particularly expert in U-boats," Vaith whispered, as Cavalcanti, a slightly built middle-aged man in a checked sport coat and drooping reading glasses, emerged from an adjacent room. Cavalcanti greeted the men warmly, but with a cocked eyebrow, as if to say, "Oh, geez, another U-boat nut in my office."
The men sat down, and Vaith asked Chatterton to tell his story. Chatterton was direct and economical. He and other divers had discovered a World War II U-boat about 60 miles off the New Jersey coast. They had recovered artifacts proving as much, yet had not been able to identify the submarine. They had checked the history books but found no mention of any U-boat within 100 miles of the wreck site. The divers had used Loran to return to the site 3 times, so the location was solid. They had shot videotapes, a compilation of which he had brought along. For a moment, there was only silence. Cavalcanti looked to Vaith with the vaguest grin, then to Chatterton. He reached into his desk and pushed some papers forward for Chatterton to sign. If the NHC was to accept the video, it had to be bequeathed properly. Chatterton had never felt so important signing his name. Cavalcanti took the tape, then looked Chatterton in the eye.
"We are in the United States Navy, sir," Cavalcanti said. "We know a good bit about what lies in the ocean. But we cannot necessarily reveal that information.
You understand that, Mr. Chatterton, correct?
Absolutely, sir, I do.
We have an accounting of shipwrecks off the East Coast. We track this for military reasons, not for historical reasons, not for researchers, or, if you'll excuse me, for divers. We have this list here. But I cannot show it to you. I'm sorry. Chatterton's heart sank. The answer was on the other side of Cavalcanti's office, and the man would not open the door. Vaith remained seated, erect and dignified, but said nothing. Cavalcanti said nothing. Chatterton wondered if the meeting was over. He was not willing to allow for that possibility.
"Mr. Cavalcanti, I don't have to see the list," Chatterton said. "I'm just interested in this particular wreck at this particular location. This has become very important to me. Putting a name on this grave is the right thing to do for the families, and it's the right thing to do for history. There are dozens of dead sailors down there, and no one seems to know who they are or why they are there."
Cavalcanti settled his chin between his thumb and forefinger. Vaith cocked his head slightly, as if to ask, "Well, what now, Bernie?" Cavalcanti nodded slightly. "Well, I suppose I can look it up," he said. "But you cannot have any photocopies of the information, and you cannot take any photographs with you." "That's fine, thank you," Chatterton replied. "I will be satisfied with you verbalizing to me whatever information you might have about this wreck." Chatterton wrote down the U-boat's latitude and longitude and handed them to Cavalcanti, who excused himself into a fortress of documents. Vaith grinned and gave Chatterton a nod that said, "Nice going." The answer was moments away. Several minutes later, Cavalcanti returned, a massive binder under his arm, and sat at his desk. He looked at Chatterton with that cocked eyebrow again. "Are you sure about that location?" he asked.
"Positive," Chatterton replied. "We've been there 3 times.
"Well, we do not appear to have anything at that location. There is no U-boat, or anything else at that location." Vaith's grin, kept in check throughout the meeting, surrendered to a smile.
"This is fascinating," Cavalcanti said finally. "This is absolutely fascinating. Let's take the videotape to Dr. Allard and watch it together. He has to see this.
I have to tell you, Mr. Chatterton, we hear from an awful lot of people who believe they've discovered a U-boat or have secret U-boat information. It's almost always nothing. But this is just fascinating." Cavalcanti ushered Vaith and Chatterton into a stately office. Soon the men were greeted by a middle-aged man with wavy salt-and-pepper hair parted in the middle, wire-rimmed glasses, a bow tie, and a tweed jacket. The man introduced himself as Dr. Dean Allard, director of the center, and asked his visitors to sit down. Cavalcanti launched into the story. "Mr. Chatterton," he said, "had found a U-boat off the New Jersey coast. Location definite, vintage definite, casualties definite, videotape available." All the while, Allard listened through weary ears. He had heard such claims 1,000 times. Always they were groundless. Cavalcanti paused a bit for effect. "Here's the thing, Dr. Allard," Cavalcanti continued. "I've checked the books. There's nothing there." Allard nodded slowly.
"I see," he said. "I understand you have a videotape, Mr. Chatterton. May we view it?"
As Cavalcanti prepared the tape, Allard called William Dudley, his second-in-command, into his office. Allard dimmed the lights, and the 5 men viewed scenes of Chatterton moving about the conning tower, then forward toward the torpedo room. Various murmurs. "Fascinating. Unbelievable. Astonishing." Wafted through the office until the 40-minute tape had finished. I can't believe there's a World War II German U-boat out there, and we don't know anything about it, Allard said.
Mr. Chatterton, if I can get a Navy ship and divers to go to your location, would you be willing to work with the Navy to identify this U-boat? It took Chatterton a moment to process the magnitude of the offer. He was a New Jersey guy with a couple of scuba tanks fighting the ocean in an 11-knot boat. Now Allard was offering to send a team of hard-hat divers and the muscle and resources of the United States Navy to solve his mystery. He began to fashion a sophisticated acceptance to fit the grandeur of the moment. Instead, he could only utter, "Definitely." Dudley stepped forward. He was the only one in the room not smiling.
"Dr. Allard, I'm sorry we can't do that," he said. "As you know, the U.S. has filed a complaint against France in international court over the Confederate ship Alabama. The heart of that case is that the French are diving on an American warship we argue has protection for being a war grave. We can't, at the same time, be diving a German war grave in America. Our position in court would be weakened."
Allard contemplated the argument for a moment.
"Well, you're right, Bill," Allard said. He turned to Chatterton. "I'm disappointed. But if we can't actively go out there and help you with the diving, Mr. Chatterton, we can still provide you with whatever you need in terms of research assistance here."
Allard stood and removed his jacket and rolled up his sleeves.
"In fact, let's start right now. Bill, would you get the pamphlet explaining our resources for Mr. Chatterton?"
Dudley escorted Chatterton to his office. He closed the door behind himself, turned, and looked Chatterton in the eye.
"I don't like you," Dudley said. "I don't like divers who touch things on shipwrecks."
Chatterton knew what was unfolding. Some scholars despised divers for their willingness to disturb shipwreck artifacts. Chatterton had resolved this with himself long ago. If he were to discover, say, a Viking ship from 1,000 years ago, he would surrender it to archaeologists. There are things to be learned and preserved from a Viking ship. But a World War II vessel about which everything is known and meticulously documented? Chatterton believed he was on good paper with Allard and Cavalcanti and the NHC. He would not force the issue with Dudley.
"Okay, that's fine," Chatterton said.
Dudley returned with Chatterton to Allard's office, where the men thanked Chatterton for bringing a genuine mystery to the NHC. Vaith and Cavalcanti then showed him to the archives, where they introduced him to Kathleen Lloyd, an archivist and Cavalcanti's right-hand person, who would assist Chatterton in whatever way possible. Chatterton thanked Allard, then disappeared with Lloyd and Vaith into a research area filled with active-duty military personnel, authors, veterans, historians, and professors. There, Lloyd told Chatterton about 4 critical research tools available to him. Each struck Chatterton as a revelation. They were 1. Anti-Submarine Warfare Incident Reports, ASW. A daily chronology of underwater contact between Allied forces, ships, airplanes, blimps, civilian air patrol, armed guards aboard merchant vessels, etc., and enemy vessels believed to be submarines. Reports could include battles, chases, sightings, sonar contacts, anything related to the hunting of U-boats. If a report told of a battle, a more detailed account, called an attack report, could be referenced. 2. Eastern Sea Frontier War Diaries, ESFWD. A daily chronology of interesting activity or observations made by Allied personnel along the American eastern seaboard. Such activity could include anything from the appearance of an oil slick to a mysterious puff of smoke to the discovery of a life jacket. Unlike the ASW reports, these reports did not have to involve submarines. 3. BDU KTBs. A daily summary written by German U-Boat Control, BDU,